Welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. I am your host, Aaron Erber. This is a podcast about stories, myths, and the Catholic faith. We're just going to start. All right. You guys ready?
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, everybody. This is Aaron, and I Might Believe in Fairies, and we have another book club edition here. We're going to do one book, but then nobody liked it, so we're going to...
So it wasn't very I didn't even start it, actually.
No, I didn't either. Andrew said he read it and didn't like it, so yep. I'm like, well, maybe we'll do something more of a classic or something. So... I chose, and this is something, Dan, you wanted to do instead of Anubis Gates. I was between those two, and then we chose Anubis Gates. And then you're like, oh, so we're going to do Dunsany. So now we're doing Dunsany. So there we go. So we're here to discuss The King of Elfland's Daughter by Lord Dunsany. So, and I'm joined here by, say your names. You go first.
Daniel.
Andrew.
All right. And then John Palmer might be joining. He was on the last episode as well, but he's having some technical issues. So he sent me a phone number, and I couldn't get through to him, and he can't quite get through to the Google Meets. So he can join whenever he can, and hopefully he can do that. Otherwise, he'll have to listen when it comes out. So we read Lord Dunsany, and Lord Dunsany was... he was a baron, I think, right? Was he like, something like that? He was a, I should have done my homework more, on his personal life. But he was of Irish aristocracy, of the turn of the 20th century. So he was writing late 19th, early to mid 20th century. And he was born as Lord Dunsany is a title. Mm-hmm. His name is Edward John Morton Drax Plunkett, the 18th Baron of Dunsany. So he was a baron. I was right. So now I'm on Wikipedia. And he wrote a bunch of different things. He wrote plays. He wrote poetry. He was friends with another Irish fairy tale writer, Padraic Cullum, something like that, who is another author I'd like to cover, who is an Irish Catholic nationalist, which is interesting, and a fairy tale writer. And Dunsany wrote a number of things, such as The Gods of Pagana, which is kind of a fictional, like, pagan pantheon that he created. And that really inspired Tolkien to write Lord of the Rings and write his Silmarillion. So Dunsany was a really big influence on fantasy, especially Tolkien and Lovecraft and other giants. Like Robert E. Howard and Gene Wolfe, like all of these guys are influenced directly by Dunsany. So this guy he's a pretty big deal in the realm of fantasy. He's not so much talked about now, which is a shame because his writing is very beautiful and worth reading. So the book we're reading today is The King of Elfland's Daughter. And to summarize this book, basically... the Parliament of Earl wants a magical lord, and so the King of Earl, the Lord of Earl, sends his son to go marry the King of Elfland's daughter, and then thus have a child that would be a magical lord for the city, the town of Earl. That pretty much sums up the plot, right?
Yeah, and their goal is just that they want everybody to know, have heard of the land of Earl, right? They want magic in Earl, so that their name will be known far and wide. So. Basically, they're vain, and they want to, and they want the rest of the world to know about their sleepy little valley.
Exactly, yeah. And their king, their lord, knows this, and it's really interesting because through tradition, he mentions that it might even be worth reading like the first page because it's really a really cool introduction to the book. So I'll just gotta find it here. Chapter 3. Flipping pages, dead air. Here we go. So in their ruddy jackets of leather that reached to their knees, the men of Earl appeared before their lord, the stately white-haired man in his long red room. He leaned in his carven chair and heard their spokesman, and thus their spokesman said, "For 700 years the chiefs of your race has ruled us well, and their deeds are remembered by the minor minstrels, living on yet in their little tinkling songs. And yet the generations stream away, and there is no new thing." "What would you?" said the lord. "We would be ruled by a magic lord," they said. "So be it," said the lord. "It is 500 years since my people have spoken thus in parliament, and it shall always be as your parliament saith. You have spoken, so be it." And then he raised his hand to bless them, and then they went. So then he sent his son.
As easy as that. Yep, we'll do it.
Yep. So he, it's interesting because he like kind of is following tradition. And the people of Elfland, the elves of Elfland, don't really follow tradition. They laugh at tradition, which is very interesting. And then he says, "My people demand a magic lord to rule over them. They have chosen foolishly," the old lord said, "and only the dark ones that know not, that show not their faces, know all that this will bring. But we who see not follow the ancient custom and do what our people in their parliament say. It may be some spirit of wisdom they have not known may save them even yet. Go then with your face turned toward that light that beats from fairyland, and that faintly illumines the dusk between sunset and early stars. And this shall guide you till you come to the frontier and have passed the fields we know." So he's talking to his son, Alvaric. So, yeah, Alvaric then goes and finds, you know, he goes to get the Princess of Elfland.
Yeah, and more, and I think the...
Hey, there's John Palmer. There he is. You figured it out.
Oh, man, was that a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I tried calling your phone, and it was... It was disconnected, so I'm not sure what happened with that. But we just started. We were kind of going through the basic plot, and I just finished reading the section on page like 3, where the Lord of Earl, he's kind of talking about, "Oh, this is bad, but hopefully there will be some wisdom that the dark ones only know." You know. And Dan, what were you going
to
say?
Oh, I was going to say that they introduce the witch comes mm-hmm. before he even makes it to Elfland, right?
Yes.
He gets magic. She sword. Crafts the enchanted sword for him that is basically necessary in order for him to reach
right.
Elfland, and that's important not only for the sword, because the sword plays a role again later in the story when Alvaric is trying to go get back to Elfland much later in the story, mm-hmm. But also because Zerundirel. Is that her name?
Yeah.
Cool name.
Yeah. So she's throughout the rest of the book as well as kind of an interesting grayish nebulous character in the middle. Like she's the witch, and she's very described as doing very witchy things, but she's not, probably because of, you know, you mentioned Dunsany's maybe lack of firm moral footing. Like she doesn't have a real clear, other than she kind of straddles the line between, as they say it, the fields that we know and the lands only told of in song.
Right, right. And the Dunsany, he, as far as I can tell, his religious views were complicated. And he was probably an agnostic. And he was critical of the church. But I don't think his favorite book is the King James Bible. Like, he loves the prose in that. And that's what and you can tell when you're reading this, like, that's, you know, what influenced him in his prose. But Zerundirel gives him a magic sword, and then he's able to go into Elfland and steal away the princess, which is really, it's interesting. He just kind of walks in, kills some trees, some magic enchanted trees.
And some guards.
Some guards, and then she's like, "Oh yeah, I'll go with you."
Sweeps
like,
her off
she,
her feet.
Yeah, yeah, she even said like, "Oh, I'm supposed to go with you."
Yeah,
and it's been told by my people that I'm supposed to go with you. So you're the one who came and got me. So let's go back to Earth.
Right, and she was good. Disappointed when the knights came out to the elf knights, because they go, they're gonna kill him. Like it's like that's sad. Like I wanted to talk to him more, you know. And then he pulls out his magic sword and makes short work of all of them. And so yeah, the witch is very interesting because she is this marginal figure. Yeah, she's like this boundary figure. She's like this. You need to go to her to get to the magical area, right? To get the sword. And it's interesting because the sword, it's made of thunderbolts. It's thunderbolt iron.
Yeah.
So she calls down. I think it's something like heaven and earth meeting. And that's what this sword is. But it's
yeah.
So like the thunderbolts, like they're like the power of God coming down. And it's hiding under the cabbages, like these hidden treasures under the. It's just weird. It's just super weird. I'm like, there's a reason Destiny's doing all this. I don't know what it is, but.
Well, the witch seems to be kind of like the. She works between the two realms.
Yeah. Yep.
She's kind of caught in the tension there.
Right.
Or maybe she's. I really like that scene where she's sweeping things away.
Yes.
Oh, later in the book.
Later in the book. Yeah, I'm sweeping things. Yeah, that's a very interesting scene.
That's pretty close to the end.
Yeah.
I shouldn't have jumped back. Yeah. Go back to the beginning. After really having it.
So Alvaric brings Lirizel back. They conceive a child. She ends up naming him Orion. And Alvaric spends several chapters like trying to adjust her to Earth, wanting her to...
Yep,
like love and understand. There's the scenes where he's like trying to teach her how to like worship things properly.
Right.
Yep. She wants to worship the stars. No, yep. Can't worship the stars.
Right.
So then she sets up like the stones. And starts worshiping. Yep. She's trying to use them to worship the holy things of the Freer. And by the way, is an example of he can't be completely set against the faith because like the Freer is interesting because he's like this. Island of I almost said sanity. It's not sanity, but he's like this one guy who is dead set against magic through the whole book. And as a matter of fact, at the very end of the book, they actually talk about how Elfland washes over and overlaps Earl entirely, except for the little island, the blessings
and all that.
So there's clearly an acknowledgement of like the church. Like penetrates and is in some way impervious to the things of Elfland.
Right, and that's really interesting because people read this and go, "Oh, Dunsany is like obviously in favor of Elfland." I'm not so sure because does Elfland seem like so? You go to Elfland and like time stops. Either stops or it's really slow or whatever. Time only exists when the king of Elfland wants it to. When he's disturbed by something.
Yep.
And it's like, is it a good place? Would you want to live there? Like, I wouldn't want to live there. It seems really like, yeah, it's peaceful. But then when he's, you know, when Alvaric first goes in there, it's like the boundaries, there's a sense of like Eden about it, right? There's like this Edenic sort of, it's like a false, almost like a parallel Eden, where the barriers between man and beast and plant and trees are down. Right, like there's that sense of like the fall isn't as bad there maybe, but also like Elfric looks at the trees and how they kind of lean over to look at him, and he wonders if they had always been trees, you know, like, and it's a kind of a creepy thought. It's like what were they before they were trees if they weren't always trees, because the troll that comes later, Lurulu, he tries to steal away a child from Earth. And like, we'll send a changeling back in your place. And it's like, well, you don't see any children in Elfland. You know, where are all the, like, they's like, they do this all the time. You know, it's like, where are the children? Like, and my thought is like, are they the trees? You know, like, are they, like, it's, but you also don't sense any like open malice from the king. You know, he just really wants to be there with his daughter, you know.
Well, the king, he just kind of wants to be left alone, right? I mean, I think all of his actions are pursuing either isolationism or to make his daughter happy in the case of the final ruins, which is what, moving back to the plot, like after Lirizel is there on Earth for a while, the king uses one of his ruins. He has his three magical ruins and I can't remember them all, but one of them is to bring her back. He inscribes it on a sheet of paper, sends it, because that's why Lurulu the troll comes the first time, is to bring it to her.
Right.
She puts it off and puts it off. She finally reads it, and then her mind is swept away with things of Elfland, and she has to return.
Right. Yep. And these all-powerful ruins that even Alvaric's magic sword can't really fight against, and when Lizarel, when he steals her from Elfland, he does it with, he tells her stories, right? He tells her stories about the lore of Earth, and that enchants her, and like she wants to go there with him. And so they escape, and they escape the first ruin of the Elf King to prevent them from leaving. And then she comes back with him, and they are going to go get married. And the Freer, which is yeah, it's really, really interesting. The Freer is basically a friar. Like, it's a really, you know, not very veiled reference to a friar or a priest. And the word, the name Freer is interesting because he is, like you said, Dan, he's the only one who is not enticed by Elfland. He's free. Mm-hmm. He's freer, you know, freer than everyone else when it comes to being tempted by Elfland. And he's looking through his, you know, book, you know, his like priest book or missal probably. And
I was going to say we call that a Bible or a missal.
A missal. Well, he's looking, you know, he's looking through it to find a rite, like a rite of marriage.
For a marriage.
I see.
Yeah. So he's like, the only thing he can find is
a liturgical order.
Right. Yeah. Is one for a mermaid who has forsaken the sea, which is a nod to Hans Christian Andersen.
And then later on. Like
it Lyra, actually happened.
It's one of the things that like Lyrizel looks back on. Like she's going to leave, and she talks to the Freer, and she's like, she can see in him that he has no more regard for her than like a mermaid who had forsaken the sea.
Yeah. Right, and he's an interesting character because he's like kind to her, and he in his head he's like, yeah, she's not going to get this. Like she's not going to get this. But then the king of Elfland is worried that his daughter will be closed off in the gates of heaven, you know, from him and won't be able to return. Like she'll be in paradise and he'll be still here. So there's he thinks there's a chance that she could be saved. And I think there would have been too, if Elfric was more patient and more understanding. But Elfric wanted her to teach people and himself the ways of Elfland. And she wasn't interested in that, you know, so he was kind of using her and she just wasn't there, like, mm-hmm. you know, in any reasonable way. She wanted to go. She scorned tradition and laughed at custom and, you know, was overall hard to manage.
Well, she was still living her Elfland, like, ways.
Right.
She had, like you said, she didn't want to change to Earth-like ways. She was...
Well, she like, was trying.
A little bit.
Yeah, yeah, toward the end, she was trying, and then... Elfric was like, well, you can't worship these things, you know. It's like, no, I'm trying to practice, you know, worshiping the holy things of the Freer. And the little bell, you know, the little bell. And, like, it makes it sound, like, so trite, you yeah. know. Yeah. But then she's like, oh, your little bell can't withstand the runes of Elfland. But at the end, it does. That's the one thing that actually does withstand it, mm-hmm. is his bell. And when you ring the bell, what does that mean at Mass? It's a consecration, mm-hmm. right, of the Eucharist. Mm-hmm. So... really, yeah, like, so you're like, okay, Dunsany isn't, like you said, he's not completely, like, dead set against the church yeah. here. He's not. Like, it's, but it's very complicated, and I haven't worked it all out.
Well, I agree that it's kind of, as somewhat florid and pretty as his writing is, it's also strangely terse and abruptly, very abrupt at times, mm-hmm. and also like really roundabout. Like, so my favorite chapter of the whole book was the luring of the people of the marshes.
Oh,
where yeah. Lurulu, like there's this, yeah. this the traveler who's going through the marsh and luring the will-o'-wisps who can't abide being lured themselves. but I found it like very, it was actually like a slow moving poetic, and I thought like a better written chapter than a lot of it. Except for this really weird thing where they're talking about, well, if someone were to watch this, they would see this and that.
Yeah.
And if someone were to watch this and that. And then about after two solid pages of that, they just say, but after all, no one was watching. It's like, okay, great. And then shortly thereafter, he says again, but if someone were to be watching, it's like, could you just make up your mind if there's a watcher?
I like when Dunsany kind of breaks in and starts to talk. Like, it's just Dunsany talking to you about whatever's going on, you know?
I'll tell you what it really calls to mind. It's like, when Dunsany wrote this, like, he didn't have the kind of crazy editing job that so many people do.
No.
Like, if somebody read this these days, they'd be like, oh, no, come on. It's got to make more sense. Yeah. Like, you got to rewrite this chapter in some ways. But I kind of like the sort of stream of consciousness style mm-hmm. of writing that he does, especially in some of the later chapters of the book. Because the very last chapter of the book, too, when Earth is like, I don't want to say subsumed, but like where the Elfland is layered
overtakes
over Earth.
It. Yeah.
Yeah, like that's a really beautifully written chapter in particular. Mm. Like the last few chapters of the book have some of the most like vivid imagery and language, and they're pretty cool. I admit I was a little bored through especially like all of Alvaric's wanderings through the whole
thing. Yeah.
And like why are we spend 80 pages on this throughout the course of the book?
It's sad. And
it's like, yeah. What's going on?
He's like slowly just losing hope. And
although I can kind of understand. I mean, he's just, you know, he's just lusting for Elfland. I mean, he
wants his wife back too. I mean,
it's there is that. But like the other guys that he's with too. Oh, it's like, what are they? You're basically on a fool's errand for how long?
10 years. 10 years? Over 12 years, I think. Yeah.
12 years, yeah.
So, yeah, just to kind of bring it back. So, they have Orion, the child, who is going to be the king, or the Lord of Earl. And Lirazel.
Returns to Elfland.
Returns to Elfland when she looks at her father's ruin, because she, the spell that her father sent. And she didn't want to at first. She didn't want to. She wanted to lock. She locked it up in a chest. And
well, didn't she know what that meant?
She knew. She knew what it was. Yeah.
As soon as she got it, she knew what that meant. So she didn't want to do it.
So she locked it up in a chest. But then when Elric and her had a fight about religion, thing. You know, you should always, you know, never marry someone who's not your religion. they had that fight about, you know, proper worship, and then she, you know, looks at the rune and floats back to Elfland. And then Elric basically abandons his son.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm going to go.
The entire book, there's like no relationship between father and son.
I know. You can see why.
Only
like
at the very end, when they meet Lyra, that's the only time they even mention them in the same sentence.
Yeah. Yeah, all three
of them. I was like, whoa. Like, I don't know how you just like.
Yeah. But in a way, you know, what's her name? Lirazel is the connection between the two of them.
Yeah. Right. And they're both searching for her. They're both like called to her, you know, but Elfric is doomed never to find her because of his magic sword, because the king can sense it's coming. And so he moves Elfland.
Draws Elfland.
And then Orion is drawn to Elfland because he can hear the horns of Elfland. And it's the when so then Elfric sets off on his quest. His mad quest to go find Elfland. And so he goes back to where he found it before, but it was gone because the king moved it.
And he literally takes with him kind of madmen.
Yes.
People who are kind of...
Trying to find that chapter.
The poet, the dreamer, the guy who's obsessed with the moon.
Exactly. Yep. There's a whole bunch of just random people that really aren't, I'd say, necessarily sane.
Well, like they have the shepherd.
Yeah, there's a few people.
The shepherd is the first one to leave.
There are six in total, and then they ended up with...
And
there's two left.
So,
and then it became just the three.
Rannoch, the lover, / lovesick, a lad crossed in love. Vand, the shepherd, a young shepherd used to lonely spaces. That's why he came. Thil, the poet, one who heard a curious song that someone sang one evening. Zend, the moonstruck, one who slept while a full moon shone on him all night. And then Niv, the madman, one witless lad to tend the horses. He was given authority over the group because he was first going to be the shepherd because he was the most reasonable. But if you're on a mad quest, you should have the maddest of you lead the quest, right? So he made Niv the leader, and then everything went really well. You know, but they never found Elfland. Oh, but they did at the end. But it's interesting.
No thanks to Niv.
No. It's interesting, though, because the group, so he assembles this band of travelers on this mad quest to go find Elfland. Because he went out there again to the same place he looked for it, and it wasn't there because the king moved it. And it's really interesting because like where Elfland was, it's just this barren waste that's been left behind. You know?
Yeah, and let's talk about the direction because it's always east. In the story.
Eden is to the east.
Yes. And I was hoping that the leather worker at the beginning, whose house he goes to multiple times, would come back again. Because that was like the thread of a good story to be picked up later on, but he never really came back.
Why doesn't he acknowledge Elfland? Like nobody who lives in the border looks in that direction.
Well, and they repeatedly say that like the leather worker knows
it's
something.
Yeah. Like they can't look there.
He would never know how close he was to like saying something.
Elfric, this is a great scene. Elfric is trying to because Elfland's gone, the barrier's gone, and it's just this waste space. And he's pointing, and Elfric's like, okay, that rock right there. What do you make of that rock? And the guy's like, it's there and we have to make the most of it. Nope. Or we have to do something like that. And it's because it wasn't there before, right? It left and the Elfland was gone and now this rock is there. And he's just like, it's there and we just have to deal with it. It's like, and Elfric's like, that's not helpful. Like, why don't you want to talk about this? But clearly, like, there's something that's very wrong with Elfland where everybody who lives near it just doesn't want anything to do with it, you know? And so,
Wasn't there part of it where they said, like, if they did look, they would stop what they were doing.
Yeah.
And kind of either go there or kind of just like, they'd be so entranced or so like in love with what it was that they wouldn't actually want to continue with what they were doing.
Exactly. They wouldn't be able, like, they were something about like, if they had to work so hard to like fill their granaries for winter or something like that. And they knew that if they were distracted from that, that they would never get the work done to survive. So they like purposefully blotted it out.
Yeah. They don't look like the leather worker would talk of anything to the north, south, west, or even northeast. But he wouldn't ever talk about anything to the east, you know? Like, what's out to the east? Oh, we don't talk about that. But of Alvaric's band of travelers, the first one to leave was the shepherd. Because I think the shepherd is the most sane. He was the most down to earth. He's got work to do, right? He's got sheep to tend. And so he's the one who leaves first.
Didn't he come back and get married?
Yeah.
He did. Yep. He married. Yep. And then... the poet, no, who left after that? Was it the lover? Rannoch the lover? I think. Was it the poet? So the poet then left, and then the lover, because one lost the hope of Alfland, and the other one gained the hope of Alfland, so they left, or something like that. Like, one lost his hopelessness and had hope again, and the other one lost his hopefulness and was hopeless, so they so they left. Really interesting. And then the only two left were Zend, who is the moon boy, the moon guy, who watches the moon and tells Alvaric what the moon intends and what the moon's will is, which is just crazy. And then Niv the madman, who has dreams, you know, his dreams tell him what to do. there's a lot going on there, too, about what sort of people would go on this, like, seemingly hopeless quest. And then Orion grows up, and he's a hunter, like the constellation.
Yeah. Well, he's kind of raised by two hunter men. Kind of, like,
take him in the woods.
Yep. Yep. Show him kind of...
One who tells him stories, and one who actually goes and...
Yep,
hunts. Yeah, he hunts in the woods. Yeah, the one that tells him lore and folklore. Mm. And then the witch, Zerundurel, is raising him, too, still. And... She becomes a very kind of motherly figure to Orion, which is interesting. So the reason I wanted to talk about they search for Alfland, and then the king is moving Alfland away because of this magic sword. He can sense the magic coming, and so he moves it away. So Alvaric's quest is literally hopeless, because every time he gets close, he moves Alfland away until he figures out how to disenchant his sword. Yeah, what happens after that? So Orion becomes a hunter and starts hunting unicorns.
Well, really,
he met the troll first. The troll comes back.
Troll comes back.
Yes.
And, well, actually, the troll comes back after when he's on the border. And that's when Lurulu really starts, like, becoming really enchanted by the things of Earth. Like, he's up in a pigeon loft and he sees all these things going on. It's like these very mundane things, but he just sees them as constant reminders of how alive everything is and how everything just continues to change all the time.
Yep.
And Lurulu takes the lash for the dogs from Orion and starts, you know, whipping his hounds.
He's the whip. Yeah.
Yes. And he's so effective that one thing leads to another, and then he just decides, well, what if you had a troll to hold a whip for every one of your hounds?
Right.
So Lurulu goes back to Alfland, talks to the trolls. They wish and wash over it for a little bit. But he
which is a good scene, too. I like that scene.
Yeah. He brings back a pile of trolls. And that's when everyone's like, oh, well, like, magic has... And by this point, the hounds have already... They killed... There's the one...
They killed the unicorn.
The chase with it. You know, and then the hounds have tasted fabulous blood.
Yeah.
So nothing else really entices them anymore. No other animal, like, they don't want to hunt anymore, because it's like they tasted the blood of a unicorn.
Which is interesting. So then with the unit between the running of the unicorn and the trolls, like, go back to the parliament. Because the parliament's talking like, oh, there's been no magic, and they and then they see these things and they can't deny that there is magic, and so they say, now it's great.
They're so happy.
We're gonna be set. Oh, it's great.
And then my favorite scene,
drink our mead.
My favorite scene.
Where the Freer yells him out?
The Freer comes in.
Yeah.
He said, cursed be Elfland and all the thing, you know. There it is. I gotta find the page. It's such a great speech.
This would be your favorite scene.
And I like, I'm not against Elfland here, but I'm his speech is so, is so epic. Let's see, where is it? So he moves. So they're all drinking mead at the Forge of Gnarl, one of the members of Parliament, and the Freer comes in. He lifted his voice from where he stood and addressed them. "Cursed be unicorns," he said, "and all their ways, and all things that be magic." In the awe that suddenly changed the mellow room, one cried, "Master, curse not us." "Good Freer," said Gnarl, "we hunted no unicorns." But the Freer raised up his hand against unicorns and cursed them yet. "Cursed be their horn," he cried, "and the place where they dwell, and the lilies whereon they feed. Cursed be all songs that tell of them. Cursed be they utterly with everything that dwelleth beyond salvation." He paused to allow them to renounce the unicorns, standing still in the doorway, looking sternly into the room. And they thought of the sleekness of the unicorn's hide, his swiftness, the grace of his neck, and his dim beauty, cantering by when he came past early in the evening. They thought of his stalwart and redoubtable horn. They remembered old songs that told of him. They said in uneasy silence it would not renounce the unicorn. And the Freer knew what they thought, and he raised his hand again, clear in the candlelight, with the night behind him. "Cursed be their speed," he said, "and their sleek white hide. Cursed be their beauty and all that they have of magic, and everything that walks by enchanted streams." And he saw, and it just keeps going, and he's just just cursing everything. "Cursed be trolls, elves, goblins, and fairies upon the earth, the hippogriffs and pegasus of the air, and all the tribes of the merfolk under the sea. Our holy rites forbid them. And cursed be all doubts, all singular dreams, all fancies. And from magic may all true folk be turned away. Amen." And it's this really intense scene.
By the way, that was a prayer.
Right. And you know, he's amiable at first when Lizarel comes. And he's like, okay, we'll try this. We're going to try this out. But then Lizarel leaves. Alvaric, their lord, leaves, and then Orion is hardly there at all. So you can see how the Freer is like, okay, this isn't good. Like, this is clearly not good, right? and
before the Elf King uses his final ruin at the end of the book, which he does, which is the overlaying of Elfland, the combination combining Elfland with Pearl, which he does only because Lirzel is still pining for the things of Earth and right. wants
the cows, the flowers, and fields, and Alvaric. And
yeah, Orion, so. Yeah. What was I saying? Oh, well, right before that point, and he basically forces that upon the people of Earl. They don't have a choice in that.
Right.
He uses his final, ruin. At that point, they're sick of it and they've had enough of the magic.
They actually went to the witch to ask if she could take it away.
Yeah, they went to her first, and then they went to the Freer. Yep. You know, they went to her first, and she's like, "I'm not doing anything.
You did all this to yourself.
But this is, like, I want this to happen, yep. You know, and the Freer is just like, "I'm just going to curse it again." Oh, man. And they're like, "We've had too much magic. Like, a little bit is fine, but this is too much."
So the whole thing kind of comes down, is sort of a cautionary tale. I mean, to me, that's how it read, ultimately.
Yeah. I mean, do you guys, did your books have Neil Gaiman's introduction?
No. Okay. Does this look like it?
No. This is I have the most recent, I think, edition that came out in the 90s. This hasn't been reprinted in a long time, as far as I know. And Neil Gaiman had, he had an introduction in this one. And he said that you get the impression at the end that this was not a good thing, you know, that this probably should not have happened. Because even though the king of Elfland, he certainly seems to, you know, there's the peace and contentment of Elfland, because it's all about him. Like, he's the one who kind of brings that peace. But it's all at the expense of their freedom, I think, because he makes all of Elfland dance and sing. And all the monsters and all of the creepy things that aren't mentioned until the very end, like, they all rise up out of their slumber. Yeah, and they start dancing for Lirazel and, like, singing. And it's, like, it's kind of a creepy scene at the end.
It very much is.
Yeah, and to me, he seems like a tyrant. Like, maybe a benevolent enough one, but he does kind of seem like a tyrant.
Well, I think when let's remember that he's manipulated into doing what he does in almost every case by Lirazel.
Yeah.
Lirazel, who is really, I mean, very, I think it's safe to say, innocent and naive, but also, like, it's super whimsical. It's just like, she, I mean, like, so this whole thing, this what might be like a damning of Earth or Earl, at least Earl, because they say it like faded into like it was forgotten.
Right.
Basically how the book ends. Well, it's basically just because, oh yeah, but I do kind of miss that. Like it was like her whim, yeah. And the king's like, okay, fine, we'll just do this.
I want to make my daughter happy. Let's do
this. We won't give anybody else any choice in the matter. So
right.
It's like her whim created the combination of the worlds, and it then was an influence over, I mean, how many hundreds of different souls.
Right.
Just because of her whim. And I think it's, we've already seen demonstrated in the book that, like, well, she's going to have to deal with consequences.
Right.
Right? And you don't,
if you're immortal, you hardly have consequences. You
know? Exactly. In the place that is Elfland, there is no consequence.
Well,
time doesn't rule, not much.
The king didn't want to use his last rune because he wouldn't know what would happen in the future. Right? Because there would be maybe consequences he could not foresee. Because he could peer into the future and look ahead, and he couldn't make out what would happen if he used his last rune. That's why he didn't want to do it. And so he was convincing Lirizel through reason, which is not not normally found in Elfland, which is, you know, he's like, I'm appealing to you through reason since you like Earth so much, and that's a place where reason is, you know?
And what's her response? She sighs.
Yes. Yes.
Well, and he's like, oh, fine. Okay.
She willingly goes with Alfric as soon as he shows up. She's like, yeah, I'm coming with you.
Yeah, and then she willingly goes back again, and then she regrets it. It's just like...
Right. So it's like, you feel bad for her, but she also has agency here. It's not like everything just kind of happens to her. It's like, no, she gets her way a lot of the time, you know, and it doesn't seem that way because she's so, like, fish out of water, you know, she has that sort of impression. But she also scorns the customs of men, and you know she doesn't have any respect for the things of the freer, and she even says that, like, your bell can't withstand my father's ruins, you know, which doesn't turn out to be true. So yeah, I don't know, John. Do you have anything to say? We've been kind of silent.
you guys are real familiar with the story, but I just read it for the first time just a couple of days ago. I got it on Kindle, so I don't know which volume I've got.
Gotcha.
But my first impression was that actually, I mean, this is a different take. It was kind of a love story set in the apocalypse in a dreamy sort of way.
Mm.
That you have the really extremes of culture and semi-human nature kind of coming together.
Yeah.
It's like a I thought it was, because in the end she gets them back, Brian and Alvaric, right?
Yeah, Alvaric, yep.
And Orion too.
Yeah, she gets what she wants back. Yeah, she gets her family.
So there's something, you know, satisfying in a way, at least for her about that, and probably them too. So that. It was more like a sorting out of things at the end of the world. And there's this other feature, a lot of the emphasis on memories playing a part, you know, places that when Elvaric is first going into the from which Elfland has been withdrawn, these trees and things that are kind of memories for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they have a little bit of magic because they are. Yeah,
yeah. Things from his childhood.
So,
that he hears. So he's in the like the barren waste. He hears the songs that he heard in his childhood, and like, he sees his toys,
right.
All the forsaken things that he forgot about, and he is there in that space, reliving those things in a strange way. Yeah, I think that with the apocalypse thing, that's a really good point, because the Eden, you know, the Garden of Eden is very present in the story in the form of Elfland, and you even have a man and a woman, you know, the father and the daughter, and then you have when Elfland overtakes Earl, and the world's kind of it's an end of the world, it's the end of the world for Earl, it's
yeah,
the end of
the
Earl.
End of the world. Yeah, it's a miniature apocalypse.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and then they referenced the garden that was left untended after, I think, after Alvaric left. It was all, everything was dead, and then it all kind of came back to life as they, Alvaric, Lirizel, and Orion were brought back together, and like the garden was sprang back to life. So there's that Eden, that Eden symbolism again. But it's like this. It's not completely good, you know.
Like, no, it's. But I was thinking of Dunsany. I don't know much about. You said he's probably an agnostic.
I think so. From what I've read, yeah, about his life and his beliefs and stuff.
My recollection of the kinds of things I know from. Not much. A little bit of William Morrison.
Yeah.
Some illustrators of the time. There's this kind of pixie fairy type stuff about the writing in places.
Yeah.
But you know, but that's in a way then too. The only enchantment is this kind of out of the way, you know, under mushroom, so to speak, places.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so but that's kind of maybe as far as kind of towards a vision of heaven or a sense of the beatific vision that someone like the author might have been able to marshal.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's kind of pasting, you know, this. And he might have been inspired by the, you know, just the general idea of the apocalypse. The best it could be is something like, you know, he was in World War I, right?
Yeah, he was. He was a World War I vet, yeah.
Yeah, so he had his own castle for the media. I read quick things in the encyclopedia.com.
Yeah.
I guess his lineage goes back to medieval times, maybe.
I think he has a couple saints in his family history too, like canonized saints, which is interesting.
Oh, wow! Yeah, I didn't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just had the impression that it's kind of seen from his literary view, which was a little contracted and not pleased with the modern world.
Oh yeah, he was a reactionary, very much so. Yeah. Much like Tolkien, except Tolkien, like Tolkien has his Catholicism, right, to kind of keep his metaphysical footing. And Dunsany, I don't know, I haven't read much about his biography, but I think I remember reading something like this King of Elfland's Daughter was his attempt to reconcile the world after the First World War with the loss of enchantment, you know. And so he's trying to cope with that, you know, because the First World War that broke everyone. And Tolkien and Lewis were both in it too, and Tolkien got through it, I think, because of his faith, and Lewis recovered from it because of Tolkien's faith, and then Lewis's faith is after that. But Dunsany, I don't know, he might have been broken by that in some way. And this is his way of like coping, like you're saying, that this is the best vision of paradise he could think of, is this timeless stillness.
I'm not sure if that's necessarily true though, because let's back up. We've already mentioned heaven, like, so like they talk about like the freer's heaven, like you can't.
Yeah, right.
In fact, the king of Elfland is scared that he might lose his daughter to the king of to the freer's heaven.
Right. No, that complicates it, right? All of these things that makes it so complicated. Like, what is actually?
And I think with all the, I think the fact that so many of the elements that he writes in the book, the trolls, the will-o'-wisps, the King of Elfland's daughter, are so enchanted by so many of the elements of Earth. Like, there's just this constant back and forth. There's this vacillation between the two worlds by choice of Alvaric, of Orion to an extent, although it's kind of subconscious for him. Like they say, it's only late in the book where they say that, like, that other half of him wakes up
right.
and realizes that, like, he's been able to hear the horns his whole life. Only now does he realize, like, what they're calling him to.
Right.
So I did not get any sense that Elfland was, that either side was inherently like good or positive or even it's really like heaven-like. It was just kind of like, this is surreal or outside of time. Or, you know, more, you talk about fairies, like the medieval concept of fairy and fairyland. Like that is, felt to me more like what he's describing, and in a way, like it's alien and terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, with the king, you find out later in the book that he was married to a human woman, a mortal woman.
Yep.
Yep.
And she'd go to Earth, like, just for a day at a time, but she eventually died because she would age very, very slowly, but she would age.
And the king couldn't do anything to help.
Right. His magic couldn't do anything for her, so that's why he, like, does not want Lyrazel leaving, because she would be subject to time. And then he also thought, well, then if she goes to heaven, you know, which he thought was a possibility, then she'd be the what did he say, the apple haunted hill, you know, and like the, I'm like, oh man, there's a lot there too, but like his, like the elf king's like conception of paradise, or of heaven is so, like, you could see the cynicism in there, but that's from the elf king's perspective, right? And then like the trolls, the only people,
it might be the author's perspective,
it might be, it could be, yeah. I mean, the you do see, like, if Dunsany is a reactionary here, and he could be, the king could be kind of like Dunsany, who wants to maintain the enchantment that he has created, by whatever means necessary, you know. But everybody in Elfland is so infatuated with change and time, and, like, you know, it could be a metaphor for, like, progress, you know, or something. Like, I don't want to, like, make it reduce it to that, because I don't think it's.
I'm sure there are college professors who have dissected this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to dissect at that level where it's like, oh yeah, this just means this. So just this is crude allegory. I don't like doing that. But there is something to that where it's like both sides, Earth and Elfland, are infatuated with the other. Mm-hmm. The Earth people because of the timelessness and the magic. And then all the Elfland citizens, I don't know if they're citizens, inhabitants, because of the change. Because of there's
denizens.
The beauty changes, the flowers change. In Elfland, you get the sense that everything is just kind of this deep blue, like this, like, I think that's how it's kind of described. And it's constantly, Dunsany's constantly describing it in oceanic terms. And like Lyrazel's constantly described compared to the mermaid who forsook the sea. Elfland is constantly described as this, like, underwater, a lot of water imagery and ocean imagery. And it's interesting because going back to the apocalypse, in the book of Revelation, at the end there will be no sea, you know, there will be no ocean, it will be gone, because the ocean is the symbol of chaos, so that's really interesting too. So I'm not sure what to make of that. But I have all these like connections, like, but I don't know what to make of them. It's like I have this like picture like of connect the dots, you know, and I don't know what the picture is because all the numbers are in a language I don't understand. So one thing that really that I really picked up on, because I read this twice now, this is like my second time through it, was Dunsany's use of flowers and birds. He uses a lot of flower imagery, like especially on Earth, and birds. So, like, for example, when Alvaric was first going into Elfland, he hears the cuckoo bird before he goes in. And the cuckoo bird, it's a parasitic bird that will lay its eggs in a nest of another species. And then the bird, the baby, will then kill the other eggs. And then the other species, the mother, will raise that as her own, which is interesting. And cuckoo bird is also associated with insanity. So he goes into, before he goes into Elfland for the first time, he hears the cuckoo bird. And then when he comes out with Lyrazel, she hears the lark. And the lark is associated with Christ. There's a lot of symbolism with Christ. And it's interesting because the lark didn't understand her. And so she forgot the lark. You know, really interesting. So, like, there's that sort of stuff. And the lark also signals, like, springtime. And then another example was when Orion was born in the time of wild anemones. And anemones are also associated with forsaken love, which is a huge theme in the book. You know, like Orion is eventually forsaken, reunited eventually, but forsaken by his mother and his father. and left with the witch Zerunderil to raise him. So there's a lot, like, he uses that a lot.
Oh, so where does the association with anemones come in?
So Orion was born in the...
I mean, Yeah, no, I meant where you said it's always associated with forsaken love. So
yeah, so there's a myth.
That's a literature.
There's a myth. The myth of what's her name? The Greek goddess of love, Aphrodite. Aphrodite, when she when her lover Adonis dies, her tears when they hit the ground up sprouts wild anemones. That's the flower. That's
okay.
Yep. And then they say anemones are red because they were at the foot of the cross when Christ was crucified, and his blood spilled on the anemones, and that's why they're red. Which is another interesting bit of folklore. So that's. I think Dunstan's aware of all these things and using them to kind of bolster up the symbolism that he's trying to convey. So that's one interesting thing I tried to dig into a little bit. So I ended up ordering a book on bird folklore, and it arrived today. So I didn't have a whole lot of time to poke through it. But, yeah.
one thing that struck me about your question about the birds and flowers, those are sort of big in Aztec mythology.
Yeah.
Did he study the Aztecs?
I don't know. I have no idea. I know he was probably very familiar with Greek and Irish folklore and mythology, and he was very familiar with the Bible. But I don't know if he knew Aztec folklore. But yeah, birds are huge. They're symbols. They're like, birds are used as symbolism in every culture. Yeah. But like the flowers in Aztec folklore, and those are huge. And like the quetzal birds, they're turquoise. They're turquoise feathers. And then other birds that are turquoise, they're seen as messengers. Like they're like from the gods, basically, because the turquoise is a divine color. And
color of nice clear water.
Yeah, and it's a color that's expensive to make, right? You can't. It's really, really hard to make that color back in that time. Yeah. So it's only associated with like the emperor. So yeah, I don't know if he did or not, but he's a well-read guy. So he probably I can't say one way or another, but yeah. And then I don't know. So I think, do we all like it?
I wanted to say one other thing quick about just his style of writing.
Yeah, you go for it.
I was reading a lot of Lovecraft last fall, and he, like Dunstan, you mentioned that he's formative of a whole bunch of different guys.
Especially Lovecraft.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And then Lovecraft's earlier writing, he had a his Dunsonian phase.
Yep.
Where he writes a whole bunch of stories. Basically before he actually dives into his horror.
Mm-hmm.
He writes just these more like dreamlike stories and sequences. Now I can totally see where they came from after writing this. And although honestly, I don't know where this falls in Dunsany's repertoire. I have heard that this is sort of
it's one of his last ones.
His fictional swan song is kind of what this is.
Yeah.
He's got really vivid, like, especially like sensory experiences are huge in this. Like,
yeah.
I don't know how many paragraphs they're like, they talk about like how, especially for like Lurulu is the vehicle for a lot of it.
Yeah.
He comes back and he talks about, you heard the calling of this and the feel of this and the sight of this. Like he just, like this endless run on sentence of different things that he feels or smells.
Yeah.
And it's really, really powerful. And that's like, I can see that from Tolkien, because Tolkien does a lot of that—the senses and the vivid, like just features. With Tolkien, you see it in like the writing and the beauty of the world around him, and in Lovecraft, you see it in like how things are not right, what things are out of place, and how is nature being twisted by some kind of malevolent force?
Right.
But in both of those, that's what the last few chapters in this really reminded me of, is seeing his descriptiveness. And it's one of the few times where I've actually like completely unaware of the work of the predecessor, but very familiar with Tolkien and Lovecraft.
Right.
So that was I thought that was a pretty cool exercise.
Yeah. Where Tolkien and Lovecraft meet, then you find Dunsany. Lovecraft listed three authors that he considered masters of supernatural fiction. And one was Dunsany, one was Algernon Blackwood, and the other one was Arthur Machen. He considered them the three pinnacles, the three masters of the craft. And then he had some other ones like Ambrose Bierce too, that maybe was a, maybe a potential fourth master. But like Dunsany, he wanted, like Lovecraft wanted to be Dunsany. He wanted to write like Dunsany. He wanted like to, he was insanely influenced by Dunsany. And Tolkien, I think, was too, as far as the mythology that Tolkien created went. Like, whereas I haven't read The Gods of Pagana by Dunsany, but Tolkien's mythology is deeply metaphysically Christian, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think Tolkien read, he was familiar with what was being written at the time. He liked it, but he and Lewis wanted to do, he's like, nothing, he's like, the things that we want don't exist, basically, like the kind of fiction they wanted to have. So like, they were like, well, let's make it, you know, which is the deeply infused Christian sort of fantasy fiction that that they kind of pioneered. It existed a little bit before them, but they definitely were the, Lewis and Tolkien were definitely the, you know, I don't know, the catalyst of modern fantasy fiction. So, yeah. How long have we been going? Don't even know, almost an, about an hour almost.
Yeah.
So, I sent some questions. I don't know if you guys had anything else to say about the questions I sent.
I do. Since I
yeah, go for it, them. Please.
I had some of your questions here. Let's see. I should read them. I wrote really short answers. These are just be faster. How is Christianity portrayed in Elfman? My right. answer was poorly. it's kind of present in the. I would say that the, to me the fear of Steinwehr is a Enlightenment rejection vision of heaven.
Yeah, I think that's his. That's Dunsany's critiquing of Christianity. In, I think his critique has merit. I think the like rejecting all of the enchantment is what kind of what got us in our place now in Christianity after like the Second Vatican Council and stuff, and like sanitizing everything and making everything beige and uninteresting. Yeah, well, I'm not that quiet about my stance on that, but not on the podcast. Well, it doesn't come up that much, but.
Well, so since they struck me first as a kind of an apocalyptic, a love story set with a kind of a vague apocalyptic setting, and I'm really not versed in all the fantasy literature that you guys have read, but I thought that you had a question. There are tensions between the Freer and the witch and the elf king and the Freer. How does Dunsany use these tensions? My answer is these tensions and others hold the heart of the love story together. Lorazio and her father, Lorazio and Elfrey. So you have this, the witch, the Freer, the elf king, kind of are poles of the tension. You know, like I say, they're not, you can't resolve them unless you just feel them as tensions holding things together.
Yeah.
And this is Elfland portrayed as a good place. Would you want to live there? Is it Paris City? I said, it's portrayed as a necessary but dangerous part of the fields we know.
Could you elaborate on that?
I really like that phrase, fields we know, for some reason. It cut me as nice and lyrical. Oh, yeah, the coming of magic at the end, good or bad. And I said, it foreshadows the apocalypse.
Right.
Right. Things will get screwed up. Who will know what's going on?
Right. Yeah, it's kind of both, right? It's because the men of Earl, the parliament, they get what they want. But it's not really what they want. And the lovers get reunited and the family is reunited. But then Earl is forgotten, you know, no one knows about Earl anymore because Elfland subsumes it. And my reasoning for saying Elfland is parasitic because, when Elfland recedes, when it recedes from where it was on the border between the worlds, it leaves this barren waste space behind. And and the trees that were, that might not have always been trees in Elfland. Like, okay, what were they? I don't know. There probably isn't much to that reading of it, but it was striking when Elfland leaves, it just leaves this barren wasteland behind that goes on for eternity. You know, like Alvar can walk and walk and walk and never reach the end of it.
It's pushing it back.
Yeah, well, that too, yeah.
I had another question. I'll just go to these questions since I typed them out. I'll read them. Yeah. If time is so destructive, why does Raziel once live on Earth? Why is she so enchanted? I said, she has a heart, and so does the Elf King. But she didn't take it seriously.
Hmm.
In a way, admirable detachment to passing things and concerns with the loves that they have, with her loves, Elvaric and Orion.
Yeah.
When you guys are talking about it, I thought, you know, there's a certain Eve-like quality to her.
Yeah, I think there could be. Yeah.
She's doing her thing. In the screw you kind of way.
Yes, that's exactly, I think, how I see her.
Yeah.
As just being, I mean, I don't think she has, she's never described, she might be a little manipulative, but to me, she seems like she's the depth of intellect and the domination of, like, sensory desire. That's why she leaves in the first place, it's why she goes back, and it's why she misses what she had.
Right.
She's the pivot, she is the focal point for the three big world shifting changes in the whole book. And they're all just because she wants to.
Right. And I think she does. Yeah. And like Eve wants the fruit, right. And it looks pleasing. It's pleasing to look at. It's, and that sensory information is enticing. And that's, you know, the serpent tempts her, and that's why she falls, is because the fruit is pleasing to look at, and she looks at it, you know. And I think Lirazel is a very good point. She is kind of an Eve because she is like this kind of innocent, kind of, right? But it's almost like she's naive. Naive. Okay. When she opens the rune and she reads it, I was reminded of, and she like flies away. You know, she, that scene reminded me of what the Chesterton line, angels, take themselves lightly, and that's why they can fly. You know, they're, and so,
oh, yeah.
And her, the end of her name, El, is an angelic, name, Lirazel. And so is Zrundrel. But she's,
oh, yeah.
Obviously not as magical as the elf princess, but they both have that like EL at the end of their name, which is usually associated with angels, at least in scripture. So, yeah, I think that apocalyptic reading is probably the best one, to read it through that lens of temptation and fall, and then recapitulation at the end. And, you know, the garden imagery, and yeah. My weird theory is Zrundrel is actually the Elf King's wife.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, that's my, because like she knows him,
and she's
really old,
within time yet somehow outside of time.
Right, like she's really old, and she can go back and forth between the worlds.
Yeah.
But they said that the wife died, so I don't know. I mean, maybe there's nothing to that. But
well, she died to Elfland.
Maybe, yeah. I thought maybe she could be his wife. And I liked when Elvric first sees her, and she's under this glamour where she looks really attractive.
Yeah.
And then she drops the glamour, and Elvric doesn't look away in disgust right away. You know, like he still continues to gaze at her without like disgust in his eyes, and that's why she helps him and makes the sword for him, because he looks at her, basically with kindness. And so then, yeah. Then she agrees, okay, I'll help you, you know. And she wanted to keep the sword for herself. but she gave it to him. And then she basically raised his son and helped Lirazel with things. And yeah, she's a very interesting character.
Yeah, that's a good theory.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just have to allow her to die, but to Elfland, but not entirely to Earth.
Right. Right.
So she just kind of looking in the meeting place.
Right. Well, John, what you mentioned that your favorite scene was, or maybe not your favorite, but one of your scenes that you liked was when she was sweeping, when Elric, towards the end of the book, he meets her out in the waste area, and she's sweeping. I think she's sweeping things toward Elfland, right? It's like with her broom.
Yeah.
What do you make of that scene?
Well, it's kind of like she's saving stuff that in Earth that's going to be lost, but could be preserved in Elfland. There's kind of this preservation thing going on.
Yeah.
I just like the scene itself. Where is that?
Well, they're in this like wasteland, and it's all rocks and dust, and she's with this broom sweeping. You know, it's like kind of this futile gesture. But yeah, I love stuff like that where it's like this. Like, I don't know what to make of it, but there's something going on. Like, Dunsany is doing something here. I don't know what it is, but it's, Any other?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Do you have anything else?
Yeah, I did like also the scene where Lurlu,
the troll,
I think too many names for the old guy to learn.
Yeah, the trolls were. I like the trolls a lot.
The troll when he gets into the pigeon coop and sees things.
Yeah,
it's like just seeing things for the first time. How cool!
Well, then Lurlu describes his like time in Elfland. He's basically just watching. Things he's like he describes watching a moment go by, you know. He's like, you never watch a moment go by, and then whoever he's talking to, I can't remember who it was, like it happens too fast. You can't, like on Earth, you can't do that. And he's like, oh, and in Elfland, you can sit there and stare at the moment as it goes by. And you see him just kind of staring at a pool of water in Elfland and not really doing anything. And that's how he kind of passes the time. And then when he comes to Earth, everything is just wonderful, you know. He it also kind of terrifying for him because he will age, you know. And they're like, well, if we sleep, we can protect ourselves from time for a little while, you know. It's like, well, that's not how it works. But I like the trolls, and I like their debate about whether or not they should go to Elfland. It's like, well, Lurlu comes to the defense of heaven, you know, that line where he's defending the angels. It's like, well, we're much faster than the angels. I'm like, well, no, they can catch us and they'll beat us into all eternity. I don't know. This book is considered a masterpiece, and I can see why. I mean, it's there's so much here. I mean, there's so much symbolism baked into it. And I'm not even like offended. Not that anyone should be, but like of his treatment of Christianity, because it's still like his like kind of criticized version of Christianity still has power. It still has authority. But I think you're right. I think his priest is kind of an Enlightenment rationalist who doesn't want enchantment. But at the same time, the enchantment isn't like necessarily a good thing because, you know, it causes people to leave their work and like leave everything behind, and then they're lost in Elfland, you know. And
it's like these kids who can't
they're lost looking for us.
Yeah, what was that, Dan? Dan said it's like those kids who can't stop playing World of Warcraft.
Yeah,
I used to play World of Warcraft a lot, and then it was too expensive and I stopped. It's like $15 a month, man. Who's got money for that? And too much time. Anyway.
It's the time.
Yeah, it's the time. You lose a lot of time. Well, it's like with Elfland, you know. You go into Elfland and you come back out, you're gone for an hour, and it's been 10 years. You know, I don't know what to make of that, but it's kind of a parallel thing where you spend time playing I have nothing against video games. I love video games. I still play them. But you do have that sort of, like, timelessness when you're playing it. And then when you stop, you realize like you lost like 4 or 5 hours of your life, you know. And I have kids, so I can't play that long anymore, which is a good thing. But you know, you spend all day playing that, and it's like you're in this, you know, you're having fun, and it's kind of like this Edenic sort of state, kind of, and then you realize how much time has gone by. So, yeah, and that's why the people of Earl who live close to the border don't even look east, because they know if they look that way, they'll be lost, and they'll want to live. They'll want to go to Elfland. So, yeah, Andrew, you haven't said anything in a while.
I think, yeah, just the last thing, I just, the book itself is very poetic.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the, it has rhythms, it has, like, it's very, like I said, poetic, and has poetry, and I just really enjoy, I think that added to the whimsicalness of the book.
Yeah.
It added to, it, I don't know, it just felt like, here I am in, like, a fairy type land, like Dan was saying kind of earlier, and it's like, this is like a fairy land in the way he wrote it, and this, the way, like, it kind of all, it flowed, was very, it was very, like, peaceful, and it just seemed kind of, I don't want to say angelic, but, like, just very peaceful.
Yeah.
And it made it, definitely, like I said, definitely felt more fairy land-ish.
Oh, yeah.
With that, and like we were talking earlier, it was very, like, beautiful scenery, and, like, with the poetry and everything, that just kind of compounded and helped the story in that regard.
Yeah, I would say it was a very, like, this was not like a peaks and valleys sort of story. Like,
no,
there was not like a conflict, there was not, right, a lot of drama. I mean, you know, there are pivotal events, but it's like it moves at a very serene pace.
Yeah,
things just kind of happen, and they go the way that they go, whether time passes or not. It's kind of interesting.
And there's no, like, real villain or anything.
Yep.
You know, not really. I mean, it's not that kind of story. I think
the closest thing to the villain might have been, well, maybe
there's a few parts.
The Freer, yeah, maybe. Also, I like the Freer.
Also, but maybe kind of the dogs, because, like, they're always talking about how the dogs.
Oh, yeah.
And anything of Elfland. Like, they have a sixth sense, and they know that those things aren't supposed to be there.
Right, right.
And for some reason, dogs and trolls, like, can't stand each other. So, right, like, that relationship later on in the book is kind of interesting, that all of a sudden, like, they're, yep, more okay, but I guess it's part of the
trolls have whips.
Whip. That's what I was going to say. Yeah. It's like that part of it, but it's, right, just interesting in that regard.
Right. Well, you get the sense that Elfland is beautiful but perilous, like Tolkien says, you know. Fairyland is a perilous place. And the joys and the sorrows cut deep. It's a beautifully written book, and this and another author who is, I think, heavily influenced by Dunsany is Susanna Clarke, who wrote Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which is another book about the return of magic to England. And that came out like, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago. And it was just another good book, but it's one of those. It's in that tradition of, like, okay, we've been disenchanted. We live in this disenchanted world. But if we want the magic to come back, maybe that's not a great thing. It could be the return of this chaotic force. But even Dunsany, he wouldn't go so far to say that, the earth, the fields we know in earth are devoid of magic. You know, earth has its own magic. And it's found in the changing of the seasons and the flowers and the birds and all the natural things of Earth. And I don't know if he would pick a side. I don't know if he'd say he'd want to be in Elfland or he'd want to be in Earth. Like, he'd prefer one or the other. It's definitely this the tension between them is what kind of drives the plot. Yeah, he's definitely meditating on the differences between them and the meaning of time and death and all the good things of great literature. So, yeah, I don't know. I think it kind of sounds like we're wrapping up a little bit here. John, do you have any final thoughts here?
Oh, I was looking for that broom scene, but I couldn't find
it. Oh, yeah, that's all right. It's in there.
I know it's in there somewhere. So, but that's okay. Yeah, let's see. I think I probably said much as I should. Could. I'm publishing a long novel that's, I want to say, it all similar to this, but there's some parallels to it. It's the background. It's you know, it's pseudo Catholic in the sense that Catholicism is sort of hidden.
Okay.
But also exposed. But the idea, it's called A Tale of Two Times. I got a website and it's on Amazon too. But it's 9 volumes long, so in total it's longer than War and Peace.
Yeah, I think Augustine sent me your grandson and my our friend Augustine sent me a link. Yeah. I think so. I do have to check that out.
Yeah. So the sort of the thing just real quick. The thing's a little similar is that the idea that time really has two dimensions,
mm-hmm.
and we're focused on the one, which is physical time, you know, which is the metric physical time, but and that's in the the old golf term for that is that's doing time of doing, but then there's another time where the gods live, and that's really the dimension of meaning. So that real time has these two dimensions of doing and meaning, and our metric time is so contracted that we don't realize that for the gods the present is much larger.
Mm.
So the king makers in the story are able to expand a event that they're in to this larger time, sort of semi-godlike, and they sort of need to because they're engaged in some conflicts with the gods, which is part of it. But anyway, so the Elfland has some of that, but he couldn't capture it very well. Like, you know, you have to, if you're really stuck in the physical or metric time, you have to think of kind of meaning as frozen.
Yeah.
You know, still. And that's not at all necessary. I don't want to go into my theory at this point, but anyway, there's a way to kind of bring things together, and the difficulty is focus from one side to the other is hard to achieve. I'd say if there's a murder and you walk into the room, you know immediately there's a murder right here, but a god is aware of the murder would be aware of it occurring over some larger area of time and space, and he would have to focus it and see who did it.
Mm.
But he would know for sure that it was done because the meaning is clear, the relationship of people of killer and killed, say. Anyway.
Mm.
So.
Well, I found the passage you in I found the broom sweeping passage.
Okay.
I could read it here.
Read it.
And one day, when the edge of earth was a wild, untended heath running down to the rocky waste in which Alfric had camped, he saw at evening a woman in the hat and cloak of a witch sweeping the heath with a broom. And each stroke as she swept the heath was away from the fields we know, away to the rocky waste, eastward toward Elfland. Big gusts of black, dried earth and puffs of sand were blowing towards Alfric from every powerful stroke. He walked toward her from his sorry encampment and stood near and watched her sweeping. But still she labored at her vigorous work, striding away behind dust from the fields we know and sweeping as she strode. And after a while she lifted her face as she swept and looked at Alfric, and he saw that it was the witch Zrundarel. After all these years, he saw that witch again, and she saw beneath the flapping rags of his cloak that sword that she had made for him once on her hill. Its scabbard of leather could not hide from the witch that it was that very sword, for she knew the flavor of magic that rose from it faintly and floated wide through the evening. And then he said, he asked her what she was doing there on the heath with her broom in the evening. Sweeping the world, she said. And Alfric wondered what rejected things she was sweeping away from the world, with gray dust mournfully turning over and over as it drifted across the fields, going slowly into the darkness that was gathering beyond our coasts. Why are you sweeping the world, Mother Witch? He said. There's things in the world that ought not to be here, said she. He looked wistfully then at the rolling gray clouds from her broom that were all drifting toward Elfland. And then he asked if he could find his way back to Elfland. And then the witch realizes that the king is afraid of her magic, which was shocking to her. So yeah, it's a really So the sweeping away the things that ought not to be here.
Yeah, that's a twist and wonder part of the story, isn't it?
That's a what?
A twist and wonder part of the story.
Yeah.
What's it's like it exposes a whole dimension and then you don't really get the answer.
Right. I like that stuff where it's like it expands it and it makes you think about, okay, what is she doing? And Tolkien does this too. You don't get an answer. You know, he doesn't answer everything for you. And he makes you work a little bit, which I like in a story. Dan, do you have any final thoughts?
No, I don't think so. It was pretty good. I was grateful to read it.
No, good. That's good to hear.
It was a good experience.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah, if you like Lovecraft, you're going to like Dunstan, I think. Lovecraft better.
I've only read one thing by Dunstan, though.
Well, that's true. Yeah. Dunstan wrote, like I mentioned, a wide variety of things. I think he wrote like a bunch of plays. So, I don't have anything else to add other than this is a fantasy classic, and it's rich in symbolism. And I think it's a piece of it's a literary masterpiece. I think so. We should everyone should read it. If you can find a copy.
Suggestions for the next book?
I think what we're going to do is I have a list of things off of the Ballantine Adult Fantasy series, plus the list that is in the, it's called Appendix N, which is the list that Gary Gygax used to create Dungeons & Dragons. And that list basically lists off all of the seminal like works of science fiction and fantasy up until like the 60s, so including Lord of the Rings. Compiling a list of those two books. Some of them overlap, but many of them don't. And then we could pick one from there. I think maybe we can vote on it, or pick one of those. I also can take suggestions, but I want to kind of stick to those. To that kind of set, kind of, I guess, canon. I don't know. I don't know if it's a canon or not. But if you have suggestions, they will be considered.
I've been reading, or actually rereading, because I read a long time ago, some Charles Williams.
Charles Williams definitely will. We can definitely read a Charles Williams novel. That sounds great.
I like Many Dimensions.
Okay.
I think most people like the first one, The Lion.
The Place of the Lion?
The Place of the Lion.
Yeah.
I said The Lion, The Witch, and The Wardrobe.
Yeah, different guy.
The Place of the Lion. Yeah, that's a...
Definitely Charles Williams. Definitely.
It's a little closer to the kind of thinking that's going on in the background of my novel. And it's somehow,
We'll think about it. Yeah, that's... Williams and Lewis are not on either list, but they are definitely in my head canon. So they're definitely a part of things. That's why I don't want to limit it to just those like two lists or the big list that I'm going to compile. But in order to like kind of keep things focused on works of like good literary quality, I wanted to kind of narrow it down a bit. Lewis, Tolkien, any suggestions are welcome. So I think that pretty much wraps it up. So I'm going to say goodbye to everybody here. And remember to rate and subscribe. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Rate everywhere you can find it. I'm coming out with pretty soon here. My wife and I recorded an episode together that's going to be a patron exclusive. So we read the poem called the Nikon Mopohua, which is the first recorded documentation of Our Lady of Guadalupe and St. Juan Diego. So that'll be good. We just finished recording it last night, and I have to edit it and everything, but that should be fun. So it'll be a patron-only thing. So I'll get that out hopefully the next week or two. Yeah, and we have some commentary on it a little bit at the end. Not a whole lot because we're not experts on it, but we try a little bit, so... so that's pretty much it. Thanks for tuning in. Hey everybody, this is Aaron. I wanted to say something else. A buddy of mine sent an email. He read the book as well, and he had some commentary, and I forgot to read this during the discussion, but I'm going to tack it on here at the end. So his name is Josh, and he says, I'll leave you to ponder one thought. He said you probably don't need need to add one more voice, so he'll leave us with one thought. The vulnerability, think of vulnerary, I surmise the words are related, of Alvaric, and by extension the men of Earl, is a welcome contradiction to the lingering sentiments of today that men can do anything he sets his mind to and is capable in the face of any difficulty. I haven't read all that much of the book, but the passages concerning the witch in Alvaric, she could have enchanted him but didn't, struck me as an indication of our own fragility and need of something higher to guard us and direct us. And I think that is very true, and it occurs in Homer's Odyssey as well, when Odysseus is about to confront Circe, the witch, and Hermes comes down and gives him the molly plant, and that protects him from the enchantment, the poison of Circe. And it's this herb given by the gods to protect him, and it's an indication that we are very vulnerable in the realm of spiritual, and it's only by God's grace that we can accomplish anything. And it's a free gift, like the molly plant and the sword that Alvaric has. It's a free gift, and we need only accept it. So that's all I have. Thank you guys for listening, and I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless.
Thank you for listening to this episode of I Might Believe in Fairies. Please leave a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Please follow me on Twitter at Aaron Erber and like me on Facebook. If you're excited to see where the podcast is going and want to offer some support for the project, you can find me on Patreon. Music is by Alexander Nakarada, and podcast art was designed by my wonderful sister-in-law, Linnea Kisby. Until next time, talk to you soon.